Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Senator Robert F. Kennedy was murdered by an assassin's bullets while he was campaigning for president. Sirhan Sirhan, who was seen by a roomful of witnesses shooting at Senator Kennedy, was immediately apprehended. Convicted of murdering Kennedy, Sirhan is now serving a life sentence at a California state prison. So the killer was caught, and justice was done. Or was it? As we will learn in today's program, the murder of Robert F. Kennedy is far from a closed case. Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, Who Killed Bobby? Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to closely examine the evidence relating to the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Is it really a closed case, or is there a need for a new public investigation? To help us examine the evidence, we're very fortunate to have with us today author and filmmaker Shane O'Sullivan. Mr. O'Sullivan spent 4 years reinvestigating the assassination, and he's the author of Who Killed Bobby? The Unsolved Murder of Robert F. Kennedy, which was published by Union Square Press in 2008. He also directed the documentary film RFK Must Die. Mr. O'Sullivan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello, Ken. Pleasure to be with you.
When and where was Senator Robert Kennedy assassinated?
Well, it was the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. It was the day of the election in California, the California primary, that was going to be pivotal in deciding whether he had a run at the presidency. And shortly after midnight on the 4th, going into June the 5th, 1968, shortly after giving his speech, he was assassinated in the pantry of the hotel.
Now, there's a lot of turmoil in the country at that time. In addition to this hotly contested race for the Democratic nomination for president in 1968, you had the Vietnam War at its height. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated a couple months before, and you also had racial riots across the United States.
That's right, and I think, you know, the feeling was that after the Tet Offensive in early 68, it seemed like the war wasn't winnable in Vietnam. Kennedy felt it was almost his duty to act and to shake up the government in power, which would have been LBJ at that time. So he made the decision to run for the presidency. A couple of weeks later, Johnson said he wasn't going to renew his bid for the presidency in 68. So it looked like Robert Kennedy had a very good chance to go up against Nixon for the White House. He was running on a platform to pull out of Vietnam, stop all the defense spending, and funnel it towards the war on poverty, which he'd been a major part of for the couple of years leading up to that. So he really became a voice of the anti-war movement and a voice of the students and a voice for the people to go up against the war machine at that time.
So he's at the Ambassador Hotel. There's a big party to celebrate his victory in the California primary. It's 12:14 a.m. He's given his victory speech. Could you take us through the events that follow the end of his speech?
He started giving a speech at 2 minutes past midnight, went on for roughly 10 minutes or so, and of course all the television cameras were there recording the speech and it going out live and so on. And then he was ushered off the stage in a different direction than his aides and bodyguards expected. So he was ushered off the back of the stage through a gold curtain by Carl Uecker, who was the maitre d' at the hotel. He went through the backstage area, and again, he turned right instead of left. So again, an unexpected kind of route switch a couple of minutes before the end of his speech sent him into the pantry. And there, waiting in the pantry, was Sirhan Sirhan. He stepped out and he fired at Kennedy, but we believe a second gunman may also have fired in the pantry, and that the story, the official story that's been presented for 40 years may not be quite as clear-cut as is portrayed.
Now, Uecker is leading Senator Kennedy through the pantry at the moment that Sirhan is shooting at Kennedy. What does Uecker do?
Well, basically, Uecker was an assistant maitre d' at the hotel. He led Kennedy into the pantry. There were up to 77 people in the pantry at the time of the actual shooting. So Uecker had a hold of Kennedy's right hand. He led him forward through the pantry. There were various kitchen staff and well-wishers trying to shake Kennedy's hand. And just before the shots rang out, Kennedy was shaking hands with a couple of busboys and waiters just by a steam table just halfway through the pantry. And then basically Sirhan had been waiting on top of a tray stacker, stepped off the tray stacker, walked over to where Euchre was, tried to reach around Euchre, brandishing a gun, and then started firing. So that's really the key moment, yeah.
And then Euchre does what? He goes after Sirhan?
Well, Euchre let go. Euchre was holding Kennedy's right hand with his left hand, so he released Kennedy's hand. And then after approximately two shots, according to Euchre, he grabbed Sirhan's gun arm and diverted it away from Kennedy. Now, that's very important because three shots hit Kennedy from behind. A fourth shot went through the shoulder pad of his coat. Yet here we have the witness who was closest to Kennedy and to Sirhan insisting that after two shots, he diverted Sirhan's gun arm away. So that Sirhan's gun arm was no longer pointed at Kennedy and couldn't have made those three shots or four through the shoulder pad that the autopsy showed.
After the first couple of shots, Euchre has Sirhan's gun hand pressed down towards a steam table, which I understand is in the pantry, and Sirhan keeps firing even though he's being held by Euchre and Euchre's partner, Eddie Manasian.
That's right, yeah. Euchre basically grabbed Sirhan in a headlock with one arm and then diverted his gun arm with the other and basically tried to push Sirhan up onto the steam table, which both of them were basically standing alongside. And then there was a great struggle on the steam table. Sirhan seemed pumped up and very adrenalized, and it took five or six, you know, quite burly bystanders and Kennedy bodyguards to try and wrestle the gun from him. So again, a suggestion that he wasn't in a fit mental state, or it was in quite a strange physical state at the time.
Now, according to the eyewitnesses, where was Sirhan standing in relation to Robert Kennedy when he made the shots?
Well, the key thing is that Sirhan was placed in front of Kennedy. The witness distances varied, but they were between the barrel of Sirhan's gun was 1.5 to 5 feet in front of Kennedy. Also, you know, we have Euchre and Frank Burns, who was an aide to the Kennedy campaign, actually standing between Sirhan and Robert Kennedy. So that would seem to imply that he couldn't have got to the contact distance at which the shots were fired.
In fact, some of the eyewitnesses you cite, Valerie Schulte, gives Sirhan's distance at 9 feet. Pete Hamill, the writer, said 7 to 8 feet. Although they did go down, it seems like the average was in the 3 feet range. You had some that were even further away than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of the key witnesses who were literally right there and were standing between Sirhan and between Kennedy tended to say between, say, 1.5 to 3 feet. That was the distance between the barrel of the gun and Kennedy's head. But then you had other witnesses. Yeah, I mean, it went up to 9 feet, I think, in Valerie Schulte's case. But there was no single witness who placed the gun right next to Kennedy's head, as the autopsy would indicate. It must have been fired in that position.
And they also said that the gun was held how relative to the ground? Parallel to the ground or pointed down?
Well, this is it as well. So all the witnesses saw Sirhan's gun held roughly parallel to the ground, so on the horizontal, aiming at Kennedy, but again, from this distance, muzzle distance of 1.5 to 5 feet. When you look at the autopsy results of Dr. Thomas Noguchi, he says that all three shots that hit Kennedy were fired from behind. The gun, because of the powder burns on Kennedy and on his coat, was held at contact distance, which means either contact with Kennedy's body or an inch away, and also in a sharp upward angle. So really steep upward angle, almost as if the gunman is in a crouched position below Kennedy at the time of shooting.
So the L.A. coroner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, cited the three bullets where in relation to Senator Kennedy? The ones
so
that
basically
struck
we have three shots that actually hit Robert Kennedy's body. One was fired an inch behind the right ear. It penetrated the brain and fragmented. So we had many bullet fragments literally in Kennedy's brain, and that was the fatal shot that killed the senator. And then we have a couple of other shots under the right armpit that seemed to be fired at a time when Kennedy's arm was raised, almost as if he had now heard the gunfire and was trying to react and take cover. So we'd never been able to determine what the order of the shots were in terms of when the fatal shot came in relation to the ones under the armpit, but certainly they came in a sharp upward trajectory from behind, and there were three of them. So if we believe Carl Euchre, it couldn't have been Sirhan who fired those shots because his arm was diverted away after the second shot. And also, Sirhan was obviously in the wrong position because he was a foot and a half to 5 feet in front of the senator, whereas the fatal shot seems to have come from 1 inch behind.
Mr. William Harper, who was a former technical investigation chief for the Office of Naval Intelligence, did his own investigation, and in December 1971, he wrote a report. What was his theory?
Well, his theory was that clearly there were two firing positions, because if you look objectively at the evidence, which I think is not something that the LAPD did at the time prior to the trial, you can see that, you know, we have Sirhan obviously seen by quite a number of witnesses firing his gun. I believe he did fire shots. We're not sure if any of them actually hit Kennedy, but there were five bystanders in the kitchen behind Kennedy and going back towards where in the direction where Kennedy had come from the stage, who were hit in various positions. Paul Schrade was hit in the head and nobody was killed, but there were five bystanders injured, and there were also a number of suspected bullet holes in the center post of the connecting door between the backstage area and the pantry, and so on and so forth. So it seems that Sirhan fired wildly in the direction of Kennedy, but may have missed Kennedy and basically fired at a number of bystanders and done some damage to the actual room itself, whereas the actual Kennedy shots seem to have come from behind. So, you know, 180 degrees different direction from Sirhan, firing in either direction, and obviously much closer to him than Sirhan was, according to the witnesses.
Could you tell us what Don Shulman, the TV employee who was standing behind Robert Kennedy, said about what he observed?
Well, again, if you go back to the audio tapes of Donald Shulman, he was recorded literally within 10, 20 minutes of the shooting, being interviewed by a radio reporter to give his view of what had happened. Again, in 71, he was debriefed by the DA's office, and again in 75. And he was very consistent, you know, each of the times that he was interviewed. He said that, you know, he didn't see an awful lot, but he's pretty sure what he saw. And standing behind Kennedy, he heard three shots. He saw three blood splotches erupting on the senator's body. And he saw a guard behind Kennedy firing three times. Of course, he didn't actually see Sirhan, but he also heard Sirhan firing from in front of the senator. But the key evidence that he contributes is that he saw three blood splotches erupting, from behind to Kennedy, and he saw a guard fire. So that links in with a security guard called Thane Eugene Caesar, who was actually along with Euchre guiding the senator through the pantry, and who was behind the senator and to his right at the time of the shooting. And he's always been the leading suspect in terms of the second gunman. And Don Shulman has always been one of the key witnesses to connect the security guard firing his gun, the position from which, the firing position B from which the Kennedy shot seemed to have come from, and the mystery around who else could have been firing in the pantry.
Now, you talked about the number of bullets. Sirhan's 22 had 8 bullets, and yet five other people were wounded. There were four bullet holes in pantry doorway. You write about 2 holes in the ceiling, 3 bullets passing through the clothes of some of the witnesses. How was this problem advanced by Stanislaus Pruszynski's audio tape and its reexamination in 2005 by Phil Van Prague?
Well, basically, the Pruszynski recording was recorded by a Polish reporter, Stanislaus Pruszynski, on the night. So he followed Kennedy after the speech from the stage towards the pantry. He was roughly 40 feet away from the pantry at the time of the first shot, but then was rapidly moving towards the pantry with his recorder on during the shots themselves. So this is the first known recording of the actual gunshot that now we've come to know and actually does exist, but was buried in an archive for 40 years. And what that contributes is that, having been analyzed by Phil Van Prague, he's found that are just over 5 seconds of shots on the recording. And analyzing them, he's found that there are 13 gunshots or shot sounds on the recording, and they seem to be coming from 2 different positions, 8 in front of the senator, which would be Sirhan's position, and at least 5 from behind, which fits in with, you know, both Harper's report, firing position A of Sirhan and firing position B of the security guard, and all of this other damage in the pantry itself. Because if you look at the 3 shots that went through Kennedy, the 4th that went through his shoulder pad, the 5 bystanders that were injured, 4 or 5 suspected bullet holes, you know, in the immediate environment of the shooting, then if we put that together with the 13 shots heard on the tape, it begins to make sense and we begin to have a clearer picture.
He also noted, you say, that there seemed to be a pause after the second shot, which was when Euchre said he grabbed Sirhan's gun hand.
Exactly. It's extraordinary the work that Phil Van Praagh did, because, you know, there was a natural pause after two of these shot sounds, and that would seem to indicate that, you know, Euchre had, at this point, grabbed Sirhan's gun arm, diverted away. Then Sirhan continued to fire as he struggled with the Euchre, but then also perhaps a burst of gunfire started from behind Kennedy, and those were the shots that actually killed the senator.
Now, this audio aspect was also examined by Phil Spangenberger, a firearms expert, who tested the .22 Ivor Johnson Cadet, that type of weapon that Sirhan used, and he focused on the time in between shots. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, one of the key findings of Phil Van Praagh was he found a couple of instances of double shots. These were shots on the recording which seemed to be fired so quickly that they couldn't have been fired by the same gun. So the interval between the shots was too quick for consecutive firing from the same gun, indicating that a second gun was used, at least in those two double shots instances. So basically, all of this was presented in a Discovery Times Channel documentary that was presented last year. And Phil Spangenberger was a firearms expert who basically took the same model of gun, tried to fire it as quick as he could, and basically the results of that test corroborated the findings of Van Praagh, that in these double shot instances, these two shot sounds must have been fired from different guns within the pantry. So again, that kind of solidified the emerging picture of two guns fired in the pantry and 13 shots from two different firearms connected with this assassination.
The firearms expert said that there was only a tenth of a second between some of these shots, and it was impossible to fire this .22 pistol with less than a half a second between shots.
I think the closest he got was, you know, three times the interval of some of these double shot occurrences. So it was just physically impossible, even for an expert, to fire the gun that quickly. And Sirhan, you know, at the time was no expert either. I think he'd bought the gun the previous March, and he'd basically gone to a firing range maybe half a dozen times in the lead up to the shooting. So he was no sharp shooter. So, you know, if an expert like Spangenberger couldn't make that interval, there's no way Sirhan could have. With obviously Euchre and various that are struggling with them for control of the gun at the same time.
Now, we've talked a great deal about the ballistic and autopsy evidence, but this was not gone into in great detail, I understand, during the trial of Sirhan, because the issue there was primarily whether he was mentally impaired.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a big problem with Sirhan's trial because, first of all, the lead attorney was busy with another case and was very poorly prepared and didn't have much time to actually prepare the case in advance of the trial, which was delayed until January, February 1969. So basically he stipulated to the ballistics evidence, he basically said to the police, okay, whatever you found in terms of the ballistics, I'll believe you. I'm not going to check it myself. I'm not going to put on a case on the ballistics in open court. I'm just going to look at diminished capacity. That was the tack he took, which was basically trying to prove that Sirhan at the time of the shooting had diminished capacity, wasn't in control of his senses, and therefore should be given a charge of manslaughter or a second-degree murder. And the thinking was, well, at least this will save Sirhan's life.
And many witnesses tell about seeing a girl in a white dress with black polka dots in the company of Sirhan. Could you talk in particular about the eyewitness account of Sandra Serrano?
Sure. So Sandra Serrano was a young Kennedy volunteer. She was 20 years old at the time, and she was sitting on a fire escape at the time of the shooting. And she's very curious because she was sitting on the fire escape, and about 20 minutes before the shooting, this girl in a white dress with black polka dots came up the fire escape with a tall Mexican-American in a gold sweater and a shorter, scruffy-looking guy who later Serrano put together with Sirhan's description. Then shortly after the shooting, the Mexican-American in the gold sweater, the girl in the white dress with the black polka dots, came racing down the fire escape, saying, "We shot him, we shot him." Serrano asked, "Who did you shoot?" And they shot, we shot Kennedy. And then they ran away. You know, this was the key evidence of conspirators conspiring with Sirhan at the time of the shooting. A Sirhan lookalike, according to Serrano, walked up the fire escape prior to the shooting and didn't come down because obviously he'd been apprehended in the pantry. You put Serrano's account together with Vincent DiPiero, who's another witness within the pantry itself, who, as he was walking into the pantry behind the senator just prior to the shooting, spotted Sirhan standing on the trace stacker, and behind Sirhan was a girl in a white dress with black polka dots. He gave a very similar description to the description Saranik gave of this girl, and Sirhan and this girl appeared to be smiling at each other. And then while Kennedy was shaking hands with the busboys and the waiters, Sirhan stepped off the trace stacker, went over and started firing in Kennedy's direction, and the girl in the white dress with black polka dots left the scene. So, you know, a key investigation undertaken by the police in the days and weeks after the assassination was basically trying to get rid of these accounts, problematic accounts of De Pierre and Serrano, who seemed to indicate that there was somebody conspiring with Sirhan in the pantry and fleeing afterwards.
And Sandra Serrano's account was also supported by a police sergeant named Paul Chiraga, who encountered a couple named the Bernsteins. Could you talk about his encounter with the Bernsteins?
That's right. Well, I mean, it's remarkably consistent, the descriptions of the girl given by these witnesses, and also the flow of action. I mean, we have De Piero in the pantry seeing the girl with Sirhan. Then we have the girl leaving the pantry, running down the fire escape with her Mexican-American accomplice. And then at the bottom of the fire escape was a parking lot into which Sergeant Paul Chiraga had pulled in his patrol car as one of the first police officers to arrive at the scene and set up a command post. And shortly after doing that, you know, just literally within 10 minutes of the shooting, a Jewish couple called the Bernsteins came up to Chiraga in an agitated state, saying again that they'd seen this girl in a white dress with black polka dots with an accomplice, saying the same thing Serrano had heard. You know, we've shot the senator. There's also another witness, a younger 15-year-old girl called Katie Keir, who again, from her description, seems to have encountered the girl and her accomplice saying very similar things, almost word perfect, the same utterances from this girl, somewhere between where Serrano saw the girl in polka dot dress and where the Bernsteins later saw her at the bottom of the fire escape. So here we have four witnesses, each of whom saw the strange behavior, saw a very similar girl in polka dot dress, but a girl in a polka dot dress that the police tried to make disappear as soon as possible during their investigation.
Talking about the police and the investigation, you note that Lieutenant Manuel Pena, who was in charge of the investigation, handpicked by the Los Angeles Police Department chief to do so, had done special assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency in Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, there were two key LAPD officers basically taking day-to-day control of this investigation. One was Manuel Pena, and the other was Sergeant Enrique Hernandez, who was the polygraph operator at the LAPD. And basically, they set out their strategy in terms of what they wanted to investigate and what kind of leads they wanted to shut down. And one of the key leads they wanted to shut down was a girl in polka dot dress. So Serrano was subjected to, you know, outright bullying tactics by Hernandez during her polygraph with him. He got her to try and change her story, got her, you know, called her a liar, threatened her in all kinds of ways. We still have audio tapes of that recording. So basically he was there to shut down Serrano, to shut down De Piero, and over him, overseeing the broader investigation, was Manuel Pena. Both of these gentlemen were Hispanic, so they had been called on by the CIA and the Agency for International Development, which provided cover for CIA operatives at that time in the 60s, to go on these sabbaticals from LAPD and do various operations in Central and South America. So that's documented. Hernandez was there in 1963 in Venezuela. Pena also did sorties for the State Department and AID in the late 60s. So their links to Washington and their links to covert intelligence work overseas was something that came out in the early 70s and would cause, you know, quite a bit of worry as to their objectivity in terms of properly pursuing the leads in this investigation.
Now, a prominent psychiatrist at Columbia University named Dr. Herbert Siegel studied the Sirhan case carefully. Can you talk about his hypothesis and how it relates to the woman in the polka dot dress?
Well, Dr. Spiegel, as you know, he's been at Columbia University almost 50 years looking at elements of hypnosis and how hypnotic programming can be used to enact pre-programmed behavior in hypnotizable people. And what he found is that Sirhan was a very hypnotizable person. Dr. Spiegel actually devised a grading scale in terms of how hypnotizable people are. And Sirhan is one of only 5% of the population who is a very hypnotizable subject. So he's quite suggestible. If he's given a program to act out, he will then then do it once triggered. You know, the trigger could be an image of Robert Kennedy. The trigger could be a cue word given by a girl in the polka dot dress. But once he's put in the physical position to enact a program, and then he's put into a trance, he will then act out the program as programmed by, you know, any of these rogue doctors who were working for the CIA on these kind of programs at the time. So the thinking of Dr. Spiegel is that Sirhan was basically a hypno-programmed assassin. He was put in place in league with the girl in the polka dot dress. The girl in the polka dot dress was the trigger, so that when Kennedy emerged from giving his speech and walked into the pantry, the girl in the polka dot dress could communicate the cue word to Sirhan. And Sirhan then would see Kennedy. He had been conditioned to feel that Kennedy was going to sell bombers to Israel and drop them on the Palestinian people, which is the nationality of Sirhan himself. And then this anger would fuel his acting out this program to fire a gun and try and kill Robert Kennedy.
Now, it's been over 40 years since the Senator Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles. Is it still important for the public to know the truth? And if so, why?
Well, I feel, you know, it was a pivotal moment in terms of U.S. politics. You know, it obviously ushered in the Nixon years and Watergate and changed the direction of public life in America for many years after that. I think on the basis of this evidence, you know, it's important that your contemporary history, the record is set straight as to what actually happened to Bobby Kennedy. I mean, he could really have changed the country, and he was the hope of many people at that time. But also on a personal level, I think, you know, we have a guy in Corcoran Prison in a high security wing next to Charles Manson, who really has never had a fair hearing in court. He has no memory of the shooting for the last 40 years, and this new evidence that's been uncovered seems to indicate that he wasn't the one who fired at Robert Kennedy. So I think purely in terms of human rights or criminal justice, the investigation is not safe and needs to be reopened.
Thanks very much for being with us today, Mr. O'Sullivan. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking with Shane O'Sullivan, author of Who Killed Bobby? The Unsolved Murder of Robert F. Kennedy. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. It's clear that Sirhan shot at Senator Robert Kennedy, but even the evidence available in 1968 indicated the bullets which killed Senator Kennedy were fired by another gunman standing close behind Kennedy. So why didn't Sirhan's lawyers put up a more aggressive defense? The following may help explain. At the time of his appointment, Sirhan's chief defense counsel, Grant Cooper, was also representing Mafia Don Johnny Roselli in a well-publicized gambling case. According to Lamar Waldron, author of Legacy of Secrets, recent evidence, including material from FBI files, conclusively establishes that Johnny Roselli participated in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. Additionally, Russell Parsons, an attorney picked by Cooper to help him defend Sirhan, was investigated by Robert Kennedy for mob ties when Kennedy was a young investigator for the Senate Rackets Committee. Referring to Kennedy in profanities, Parson reportedly later said he never forgave Bobby Kennedy for investigating him. Now, as to Professor Spiegel's theory that Sirhan may have been hypnotically programmed to murder Senator Kennedy, Mr. O'Sullivan notes the following. During the 1950s, the CIA was researching mind control under secret programs named Bluebird, Artichoke, and MKUltra. According to Mr. O'Sullivan, these CIA programs included research on hypnotic programming and the possibility of creating a programmed assassin. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.